Today, on The Exam Room.
When we peer through all of the press, right, it's not the full publication. We don't have all the full data with it. And so what we're seeing is we're seeing a survey that was done, and we're looking at the proportion of individuals, and there's a lot of questions that are being asked that come out of this as opposed to clear, distinct answers in terms of outcomes. So yes, the data did suggest perhaps an increased risk of cardiovascular events. But when we go pause on this for just a moment, right? And we look at this, we look at the breakdown, we say, well, okay, there are a higher percentage of smokers. Then we have no idea about the quality of foods that they were eating. And so there's a lot of questions that start to come up in terms of the demographics. So I think if anything, this study just poses questions, but the fact that it contradicts some randomized studies that have been done looking at diabetes and all the beneficial effects of time-restricted eating, it makes me question really the validity of this. And I really look forward to seeing the full publication of it. But on surface, I'm seeing a lot of areas that raise an eyebrow of concern about the validity of the study.
Welcome to the Exam Room Podcast, brought to you by the Physicians Committee. Hi, I'm the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll, raising health IQs coast to coast and around the world. Hi to the Exam Roomies listening in Reno, Nevada, Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Jakarta, Indonesia. Wherever you are, we appreciate you helping to make the world a healthier place. This is episode 35 of season 7, number 534 overall. Heart disease. It is the leading cause of death. And today we are going to be talking about five new studies that you need to know with one goal in mind: keeping your heart beating healthy for years to come. And our guest today is Dr. Columbus Batiste, a board-certified interventional cardiologist and assistant clinical professor at the University of California, Riverside School of Medicine. Now, some things with these findings are causing us to, well, rethink some things already. And others, although these studies have really just been published, they're coming under some heavy scrutiny. So here are the five studies that we will be getting into on the program. Number one, fasting and heart disease. Second, salt and longevity. Number three, eating fish can save your life. Yeah, you know there's more to that story. Number four, probably you've heard of this one, eggs being heart healthy. That is splashed all over the headlines, but we're going to be diving deeper into those findings and who might be behind them. And finally, heart disease rates are falling, but not for everyone. We're going to tell you who is being left behind. Plus, some questions from the exam roomies, including one on calcification of the arteries. Is it 100% reversible 100% of the time? But before we get rolling, a reminder for the roomies in beautiful Seattle, Washington, that I'm going to be speaking there at the Planted Expo on April 21st. Now, this is a big two-day event, but I'm going to be there Sunday the 21st at noon, right after our dear friend Carly Bodrug. And there is a special offer just for the roomies who want to come out to one of the biggest and baddest plant-based events on the planet. Use the code EXAMROOM at checkout to save 15% on tickets. That is one word, EXAMROOM, to save 15% off single day or weekend passes. And tickets and a full speaker lineup can be yours right now by visiting plantedlife.com or just click the link in the episode notes. Okay, let's go ahead and turn our attention to the heart and a great conversation with Dr. Columbus Batiste. Five studies you need to know about your heart starts right now on the Exam Room. Great to see you, my friend.
Oh, likewise. Always good seeing you. How are you?
I'm doing great and really looking forward to the release of your new book, Selfish, which is coming out at the end of April, man. This is very exciting.
I am. I'm going to tell you, I'm excited. It's one of these things I never thought I was getting into this game to become an author. But, I just felt like there was a void and there was an area that when you get selfish, that the selfish can fill that void. So I'm looking forward to dropping. Hopefully it'll help one or two individuals out there.
I think that it will. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that book a little bit later in the show. But let's start with this big new research that's out on fasting. So many people have been raving about the benefits of fasting. But then this new research, Dr. Batiste, comes out and it shows that fasting actually can increase a person's risk of developing heart disease. What are we learning here beyond that?
Yeah, I think that with this, we have, when we peer through like all of the press, right? So, I mean, press and headliners are really the thing, that whole one-liner. We have to see that what type of study we're dealing with is we're dealing with a review, right? And so in that review, this is an abstract. It's not the full publication. We don't have all the full data with it. And so what we're seeing is we're seeing a survey that was done and we're looking at the proportion of individuals. And there's a lot of questions that are being asked that come out of this, as opposed to clear, distinct answers in terms of outcomes. So yes, the data did suggest perhaps an increased risk of cardiovascular events. But when we go pause, my kids say, pause, dad, you know, and I have to correct them and let them know I'm still your father. But when we pause on this for just a moment, right, and we look at this, we look at the breakdown, we say, well, okay, there were a higher percentage of smokers inside of the cohort who were fasting, quote unquote, less than, or they're eating in time-restricted eating of 8 hours. Then we have no idea about the quality of foods that they were eating. And so there's a lot of questions that start to come up in terms of the demographics, in terms of the constitution of the foods that we're eating, as opposed to just a survey that's being done. And not to minimize the surveys, because sometimes that's how we get information. So I think if anything, this study just poses questions, but it's the fact that it contradicts some randomized studies that have been done looking at diabetes and all the beneficial effects of time-restricted eating, you know, in terms of decreased inflammation, in terms of decreased augmenting weight loss, in terms of the cardiovascular burden. It makes me question really the validity of this. And I really look forward to seeing the full publication of it. But on surface, I'm seeing a lot of areas that raise an eyebrow of concern about the validity of the study.
All right, let's take a look at just kind of that top level highlights of what the study actually found in terms of specific data. It said that people who followed a pattern of eating all of their food across an 8-hour window had a 91% higher risk of death due to cardiovascular disease. The increased risk of disease was also seen in people who were living already with heart disease and cancer. And among the people with existing cardiovascular disease, an eating duration of less than eight was also associated with a 66% higher risk of death from heart disease or stroke. Interestingly, though, it said that time-restricted eating did not reduce the overall risk of death from any cause, and eating more than 16 hours in a day, which is a pretty wide window, was associated with a lower risk of cancer mortality among people who are already living with cancer. So I guess a slight benefit there. Any big things step out to you beyond what it is we've already talked about from those highlights?
You know, not really. I mean, so one is the headliners are worrisome. They're concerning when you look at it and you say there's a 91% increased risk of cardiovascular events. But I think we have to begin the process of always asking questions and trying to get to the bottom and trying to understand what's really being asked, right? And so in this particular situation, once again, like I mentioned before, we look at the demographic breakdown of the individuals. We look at some of the concomitant risk, whether or not it's smoking. We look at some of the other aspects as it relates to the quality of food, which is really an unknown. As I went through the abstract looking, there are no supplemental, I wouldn't expect inside of a poster abstract presentation. So it's giving an information that does indeed raise questions. What I would tell everyone is focus on the quality of foods that you're eating. Right. And that's what this program is about. That's what PCRM is about. That's what I'm about. The quality of the foods that you're eating is the most important aspect of what you can do on a day in, day out basis. And then we know to augment some of the benefits, Yeah, there have been studies that have shown, numerous studies, shown the beneficial effects of time-restricted eating, of giving your body time to rest, of having at the cellular level. So that's what I would say that's what I'm telling my patients right now. That's what I'm telling my colleagues as they've come and we've had discussions surrounding this, is I just, you know, as I said, give pause. It makes us concerned. Right? It raises an eyebrow, but it's not an issue in which I'm changing my recommendations at this point to anyone.
Yeah. And I think that you kind of hit on something there. But it also kind of makes me think like, well, now, wait a minute. I would think that a health conscious individual would be the one who would turn to fasting, the person who is already eating a predominantly plant-based diet, lots of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, things that we know can really nourish our body and help out our heart. But then I also think to the, I guess, devilish side of me back in the day when I was thinking, you know, well, I can eat whatever I want in this 8-hour window and go to town. And for me, that would be like, all right, well, let's see if we can hit the drive-thru 3 times in 8 hours and I'll still be healthy. So I guess it all depends on educating the person who is actually doing this to know that, yeah, it's not just the time, but it's the quality of food that you are also just mentioning. And I'm sure that you've seen that in your patients, both you know, kinds of thought there, both schools of thought, I would imagine you've seen with your patients as well.
Absolutely. The honest truth is, when I'm in the community, I see oftentimes that people are looking for a quick fix, something that they can keep doing what they're doing, that they want to do. You know, it's almost like when you go to your friends and you're asking for opinions. You keep asking for an opinion until you find that friend that's going to give you what you want to hear. And so many times people want to continue to eat in the fashion that they've eaten already, but they want the aesthetic goals. They want their weight to decrease, to fit inside of whatever clothing that they're in, or they want their blood pressure to improve, but they want to continue to eat the way that they're eating. We see it, and although we're not talking about this right now, this is one of the biggest concerns I have about the semaglutide craze right now, in terms of the GLP-1s, and in terms of individuals who are trying to continue to eat the way that they've eaten. But now it's like, okay, well, I'm just eating less of the same stuff and I'm not having to deprive myself, right? And so whether or not that's in the context of time-restricted eating, or whether or not that's in the context of using pharmaceutical agents to augment weight loss and other outcomes, I think we have to be concerned about it. Boils down to that quality of food that a person is ingesting on a day in and day out basis.
I think that is spot on. I feel like we could also break down this study a little bit further, but there are a number of others that I want to get to here as well. One that is a little bit less up for debate, and by a little bit less, I mean a ton. No surprise here that researchers again have found that lowering a person's salt intake can add years to their life. What have we gleaned from this new one that I believe looked at over 35,000 people? That's a lot of participants here.
Yeah, this study was great because what it did was it was just a meta-analysis. It was an aggregate of numerous studies that pulled together in terms of some of the data and the outcomes for, like you said, Chuck, a lot of information that we've known for a long time. I always say a little bit adds up to a lot. Now, I typically discuss that as it relates to disease and metabolic syndrome, that a little bit of increased weight around the waist, a little bit of elevated triglycerides and cholesterol, a little bit elevated in blood pressure, adds up to an astronomical large amount as it relates to cardiovascular outcomes. And the same thing happens to a little reduction in the salt and sodium intake. And to my patient's point, whenever I ask them about their sodium intake, they say, "Doc, I never add salt to my food." They're so correct, because we know studies have shown that over 85% or 80 to 85% of the sodium ingested is from ultra processed and processed foods. So this study brought to the table, once again, adding to the power that the reduction in the sodium intake has the power to decrease the burden of events. Now, why is that? Well, we understand that decreasing the salt and sodium intake, it has astronomical benefits on blood pressure. Hypertension is one of the number one contributors to cardiovascular death globally, as it pertains to stroke and heart failure, and eventually in cardiovascular disease just in general. And so if we can decrease that burden, each millimeter matters in terms of exponential potential beneficial outcomes. And that's where the power of that lies. You know, I was just counseling someone about about moving over to a whole food plant-based diet and say, okay, listen, we're going to go in hard. All right. Now I have two stories for you. And one was personal, my own brother. I kind of said, listen, we're going to go hard on this, you know? And so, you know, already seeing the blood pressure drop after several days. And he's seen, and so that whole food plant-based diet didn't include processed standard American diet, vegan style. This was foods that were rich in fiber and nutrients and potassium rich. And so when you begin to get that, and you know that you're getting enough sodium that you need for your bodily function from these foods of the earth, that's where the power lies. That's where the beneficial is. And I share with him the fact that elevated blood pressure, stage one hypertension, as we get older, still does portend to an increased risk of events of stroke and heart failure that's significant. And so we can't minimize the impact of every effort that we do to lower our risk.
Here's what is interesting to me also about this study is that they didn't eliminate salt completely. As a matter of fact, they used salt substitutes that had about, 3/4 the amount of regular salt in their sodium chloride. And then they replaced the missing portion with potassium chloride, right? So they call that a salt substitute. So I think then if I were to just take salt completely off of the table, then the benefits could be even larger. It seems like the study, you know, they could have gone a little bit further to me if they're only taking 25 to 30% of the salt off of the table for the participants here, Doc.
But you know, that's very reminiscent of the DASH diet, right? So DASH diet recognized the power of a vegetarian, a whole food plant-based diet in terms of decreasing the burden of hypertension and cardiovascular events. The negotiations, the compromise, the consensus was, well, we want to reach more people. That was the consensus because we don't think people are smart enough to listen to the prescription, the recommendations, and follow it. So we're going to say, we're going to give you a little bit of animal proteins and things of that nature and salt and so forth. And if we can get enough people to partake of that, it's going to still help on a global or a large scale basis. That's really where many times we go from epidemiology and large scale. So by decreasing a portion of it and showing that it still is beneficial, they're saying, well, you know what? Even every little step that you take along the process of the journey towards achieving health is powerful in its benefit. That's how I interpret this. And you're absolutely correct. But why stop at just a small amount? You know, it's like I tell some of my patients, if they're listening out there, they know I've said this in the past, which is a marathon is 26.2 miles, right? So we're not going to stop at 5 miles or at 10 miles. We need to go push through to the final finish line. And so to achieve that gold star or the reward. And so same thing as it pertains to health, we want to go ahead and push through and lower that sodium intake there. But we can start off at this point as our taste buds begin to transform. And if I'm not fully committed in terms of my environment or my support system that's there to help me, and I haven't quite made up my mind, once you start to see the gains, now you're like, okay, I'm ready to go. I can do this a little bit more because I've seen those gains, right? I'm getting those gains in the gym or in gym of life called, that's important.
Absolutely. So they were using potassium chloride in the study. What are some substitutes that you might recommend? What do you recommend for the patients you're counseling?
Yeah, you know, I end up going really more in terms of the seasoning. So I increase in terms of the spices, if they're able to tolerate it. So whether or not it's the cayenne, I have the garlic, the onions, and so forth. I tend to increase the celery, which gives it a little bit of that salty-like taste that's there. So especially if a person is prone towards cooking, that will help and that will kind of add to it, as well as lemon and these things. So that's usually where I go for my own personal self, and everyone can tolerate this, but my folks are from New Orleans. I increase the spice. So the cayenne, all the peppers, and that helps me. That made it easier when I transitioned over to a whole food plant-based diet in terms of the way my approach to eating. So something I carry on to this day.
Let's go ahead and open up the doctor's mailbag. I want to take a question from Richard here and kind of nerd out for us, Doc. Explain to us exactly how sodium actually hardens the arteries and makes the heart have to work that much harder. What is actually going on inside of us when we eat just these sodium bombs after sodium bombs after sodium bombs?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's several different mechanisms of how this, and so focusing on one of them, we know that there is increase when we look at blood pressure just in general. Blood pressure is a relationship between the volume of blood along with the stiffness of the vessels. Now, there's several things that, and the stiffness of the vessels we technically called arteriosclerosis. Arteriosclerosis is a manifestation of really of inflammation that occurs. We most predominantly attribute that to the effects of cholesterol and that infiltration, oxidation that begins to happen that's there. We also see a very similar type effect of that sodium impact on the endothelial cells, that lining of the vessels that make them dysfunctional. The dysfunctional nature of the, when the sodium impacts that endothelium, and multiple things can occur with that, that area, that lining of cells can allow the body to respond appropriately to dilate and to constrict. But when that is impaired, that function, it stays rigid, right? And so that begins the process. And so we know there's studies, a wonderful, beautiful research that was done out of the Journal of American College of Cardiology several years ago that looked at the systemic effects of sodium ingestion and how that impairs not only the endothelial cells, but multiple aspects of the body. And so that's just one. So once you get that hardening that's there, what's called your total peripheral resistance increases. Now I have my stroke volume increases. And so now I'm having an elevation in my blood pressure that can increase by dual mechanisms. We oftentimes think of sodium as just increasing the fluid, right? And that, you know, that's there, but it's more than just that. It does impair the endothelium, which may play a role in terms of the stiffening of the vessels or the impairment of the vessels that leads to the elevated pressure.
And then you want to talk about a little bit adding up to a lot here. Another study that was published a few years ago in the European Heart Journal found that just by not putting any salt on your food at the table, right? Not even talking about what's already been in the meal when you're cooking it or it's been pre-prepared. Doing that, if you're a man, can add more than 2 years to your life. And if you're a woman, a year and a half. Yeah. Just by not shaking on salt at the table. I can't imagine that comes as any big surprise to you, Doc.
Not at all. I mean, especially when you understand. Now, I'm not a chef, although I've dibbled and dabbled a little bit inside the kitchen time to time again. But we understand that 1 teaspoon of salt equals about 2,000 milligrams of sodium. So I always say there's two types of chefs and there's two types of individuals. There's individuals who are very measured and precise and they're measuring everything. And there's others who just go by the feel. They're going to shake a little bit on. Well, I think it's clear that we have no idea the amount that we're adding. We think we're adding, we don't estimate that correctly. So when people are shaking a little bit of salt, sprinkling a little salt, they may be adding just by that sheer nature, 1,000 milligrams, 1,500 milligrams, maybe even some instances, 2,000 milligrams to their food just by this added addition of sodium. And so when you take that off, and imagine if you multiply that times multiple meals of just this shaking of salt, it's easy to understand how that can add up to an awful lot in terms of the reduction in terms of events.
And you're talking about 1,500 milligrams. Isn't that the daily limit? Isn't that like, and you're talking about just by shaking it on at one meal, you do that multiple times throughout the day. That's a big, big difference there, Doc. Big difference.
That's right. Absolutely.
Let's move on and talk about another study. This one is kind of causing a lot of people who run in our circles to sit up and say, yeah, but... And this particular study shows that swapping red meat for oily fish has been recommended over in the UK. It says that it could save up to 750,000 lives by the year 2050. So just in the next quarter century or so. So with the yeah, but caveat here, what are we talking about, Doc?
Yeah. So let's partition this off, Chuck, for a second, right? It's easy to kind of stay focused on if I eliminate and take off the environmental impact, if I eliminate and take off in terms of the moral or ethical aspect in terms of with the fish, and we speak solely to health. One would say, okay, well, yeah, haven't there been studies that have shown that pescatarians and people ingesting fish and moving away from beef and chicken do better than others? And maybe there has been. I think the biggest concern is this, is what studies are telling us, besides the dioxins, besides the mercury and these inferences, is we're seeing in a study recently published in New England Journal of Medicine about the microplastics. And these are basically from the pollution of our oceans, that what this is being absorbed into our fish. And so when people are ingesting the fish, we're seeing the increased absorption of the microplastics as another avenue of an impact in the body. And we're seeing this, that the studies were basically showing evidence of this inside the carotid arteries, these vessels that supply our brain, obviously where we think and we reason and so forth. And so I question the long-term benefits of taking this strategy as our prime strategy towards trying to decrease the burden of cardiovascular disease, despite the impact on the environment and the ocean and so forth. So that's not one in which I would advise individuals to partake, especially with the growing data about microplastics. Now, with that being said, have I, from a solely health perspective, because once again, that marathon analogy, I want folks to go whole food plant-based. I want them to move as close to that as they can, not only for their beneficial, their health, but for the environment too as well. But I understand that for some, it's such a foreign concept, that it's something that they haven't entertained, that I have to begin the process of moving them forward. So have I told patients, yeah, I want you to transition. Let's get off of the pork and beef and the fried chicken and so forth and transition over to fish here initially if they are resistant towards going completely whole food plant-based? I have. But as the science has continued to evolve, and this is with me cautioning them about the pollution and the impact of mercury and dioxins and so forth, with the growing data as it relates to microplastics and the impact that it has, I've cautioned them that that is going to be equally a problem. And as growing research increases, we're going to really question whether or not you should be doing that as well. And I would say, stop that as well. And that, listen, for your health, if you want forgiveness, I'm going to give you forgiveness for partaking of it. But I'm definitely not advising you to go down the road of ingesting fish for the purposes of health.
Let's go top line on the study here, just for those who are curious. The researchers say that they suggest replacing 8% of red meat in their diet with these, what they call forage fish, could prevent 10% of heart disease deaths, while also reducing deaths due to stroke, diabetes, and bowel cancer by 1 to 2%. However, they say that if you do that, it's important not to replace red meat altogether because there are still some important nutrients in there. And so this is where the School of Nutrition Education really needs to come together and beat this drum a little bit louder here, because they say, look, you know, the NHS over in the UK where they did the study, they say that, you know, it's important to eat beef and lamb and pork as part of a healthy diet so that you can get protein, iron, zinc, and vitamin B12. But we also know here, Dr. Batiste, based off of the 520 some odd episodes that we've done of the show, the many times that you have been on, that when you take the fish and the red meat and all other meat and dairy off of the equation, your risk of all of those ailments, the cancer, the stroke, the diabetes, heart disease, it plummets way more than the 10% they're touting here.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, listen, I mean, if someone's going to start off a recommendation by giving me clear, false science as it relates to the impact of eating pork, the importance of red meat, of pork, lamb, and beef, that is something that has been distinctly, continually shown to be problematic as it relates to cardiovascular events, to cancer, and so forth. And so that recommendation for that, I think that that is beyond ill-placed. When we look, so that's a major issue. When we look at about heme, we understand that the heme from animal protein, what it does to cardiovascular events, that is not beneficial at all from the iron that's there from heme iron. And the protein, that goes without saying in terms of, we've discussed that ad nauseum in terms of this concept of a protein deficiency and the need to attain it from animal proteins. So I have a big problem with it. I believe that once again, our society is mixed in our recommendations based off of what we want to do based off of our culture. So if the culture is, I want to eat this and I'm going to persist down this avenue, I'm going to give very tempered response in terms of what large population should do. I think that's problematic. I think we have to be truthful in terms of the outcomes and saying that, listen, this has been shown to be a detrimental outcome. If it's red light, don't go through. That's why I tell patients, you don't drive through red light, you don't eat these red light foods. That's a red light food. If it's a yellow light, when I'm teaching my kids, to drive, and that's been several years ago now, I said, listen, you don't need to drive through a yellow light. There's going to be rare situations in which that's the case. There may be some products in there from an evidence base where it falls into that, but the risk benefit says stay away from them. Stay away from it. I don't need complete. And the green light foods, have it as much as you want. And so I think there's a big problem with these generalized recommendations that still allow individuals to eat these foods that have been associated with so many chronic disease ailments across the world.
All right. Let's also talk about healthier alternatives in terms of sources of the protein, the iron, the zinc, and the B12 that somebody eating a plant-based diet could turn to, or somebody who's plant curious and is like, oh, okay, well, they're saying that maybe I don't have to eat fish or red meat or dairy in general to get these things. Protein, we know, I don't want to spend a lot of time breaking this down because it's just about in everything that you eat there, Doc.
Yep. That's right. Everything. So here's the beautiful part. When you look at the blue zones and longevity, all the foods, the overlapping foods that are culturally relevant across the globe, whether or not it's in some form of beans and legumes, whether or not it's in forms of potatoes, whether or not it's in forms of vegetables, that all these things are going to contain the nutrients you need to survive and to thrive and to be well. That's where the power lies. So that's where I think people get caught up in the recipes and how do I do it? And they forget to realize that these are staples across the globe. And the foods that we've eaten on a regular basis of rice and beans and corn and potatoes and squash and so many different varieties of things that have been constructed in a form and format that's consistent with many cultures around the globe.
B12, obviously, most people eating the plant-based diet, they get through a supplement. But what about iron and zinc? What would you recommend somebody consume to make sure that they're getting an adequate amount of those nutrients?
Yeah, a lot of your legumes are going to be fairly high in terms of your iron and your zinc that will help maintain that with you. So, I mean, I definitely recommend a diverse diet as much as possible. And so that's one of the things that can be a challenge for everyone because we all tend to get in ruts and we like what we like and so forth. But I think the more colors of the on our plate, I think the more diversity in terms of the food that lends itself to gut diversity, that lends itself to nutrient diversity that we're able to achieve everything that we need.
All right. And let's move on and talk about another study here that has definitely been a talker around the office here. Eggs yeah. and cholesterol. Another study coming out showing that these so-called fortified eggs don't really have much of an impact at all on a person's dietary cholesterol. I know that you just spent time at a big cardiology convention. Were you and your colleagues talking about this study there as well?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, I had one of our mutual friends and colleague, Dr. Bernard, was there too as well. And so it was good to see him amongst a lot of other leaders in the plant-based world, as well as the general cardiology community. I think the part that saddened me about this study was just really the advertisement and the promotion of a negative neutral study. A study that did not show a benefit, but was touted because perhaps it did not in the time frame in which it was performed, this abstract, did not show a tremendous raise in cholesterol. When I look at things in the small number of patients, we have seen consistently a back and forth. We understand the impact of industry. We understand there's multiple confluence issues that are coming into play into why it's being promoted. I tell patients once again, not everything that counts can be counted, and we're seeing enough of the evidence, right? So just because the study did not demonstrate an elevation in cholesterol in comparison, and so I wasn't able to read, once again, similar to the time-restricted feeding, a full publication regarding it, only the abstract. So there's still a lot more that I need to kind of parse through. Give pause, once again, pause, as my kids say. This isn't a license to go and have your whatever way you make your eggs. This is a more of an issue of saying, okay, wait a minute, well, who funded this study? Why was this being done in this particular instance? And the second question is this enough for me to contradict all the other mountain hills of study from Nurses' Health Study and others regarding the amount and the impact of eggs consumption and cardiovascular events and diabetes and so forth?
So just concede this one with caution. And I do not have the industry disclosures in front of me, but I do believe that this was, in fact, funded by a particular brand of eggs that is being sold. That's why they call them fortified eggs, if I'm not mistaken. That is the group that funded this particular research, correct?
That's my impression. That's my impression as well.
I will double check that. If you're listening to the podcast, when I come out of this interview and do the show wrap up, I'll have that 100% answer for you. And it is very confusing. I do know also that I read a big expose recently in the Washington Post that looked at dietary influence that big industry has had. And they have shown over the last two decades or so that as our health generally as a society has decreased, the amount of dollars that are being paid to these dietitians to talk about these sorts of things has really ramped up. And so that's where we're getting a lot of the confusion online, where, you know, you can lend your voice for a paycheck, but the person who's doing that, I don't think Dr. Batiste necessarily realizes the power that comes in that and the negative ramifications that could come for somebody's health because they're talking about things like this. And it does concern me. And the Washington Post in particular was talking about you can eat anything on a healthy diet, everything in moderation, including moderation type of philosophy. But you can't tell me that eating a dozen eggs every morning is going to be a healthy option. You can't tell me, you know, including ice cream every night is going to be a healthy option. It's just common sense at some point has to kick in, no matter what it is that you read or hear on the internet.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, one of the things, I mean, I'm not sure how much evidence we need to continually tell us the impact of some of these food consumptions and what it does to our cardiovascular system, our endothelium, many other aspects that are there. And what I can tell you from just in practice, I mean, I'm a practicing cardiologist, and I've seen individuals, some of whom appear healthy, their nutrition is poor, and they have horrible disease. I have seen patients who, the flip side as well, but the vast majority of individuals who I have seen, what you do and put into your body to any degree plays a role in terms of your outcomes. And so we really have to look at, is this really helpful to our bodies long-term or not? I mean, one of the things, I was just having this conversation with a patient just yesterday. When you look at the likes of sports greats like Tom Brady and LeBron James, and even if they're not completely plant-based, they are plant-forward in terms of their lifestyle. One of the things that you see is you see this concept of the rising fastball. You're like, well, how are they able to perform and still do what they're doing at such an older age? Well, part of it is what you put into your body plays a role. And so as we pour into our bodies the foods that are beneficial, that are health promoting, as opposed to disease forming or even disease questionable, right? So even if you want to put something in the category of, it might, you don't know if that might is going to turn into a for sure inside your body. Why even go down that road if we're looking just solely at health alone? And so, because you only get one shot at this thing called life. And this idea and the concept of cardiovascular events and the growing burden that despite all these efforts and these promotions of egg and beef and all these things, our numbers are still abysmal. Our rate of health and globally inside the United States for industrialized countries, we still pale in comparison. There are multiple factors, but at the core is the concept of food insecurity, which means lack of nutritious foods, which really extends, although that's specifically talking about those who are financially distraught. Really, I believe there's food insecurity inside of many wealthy individuals because they're eating very nutrient-poor foods, energy-dense, and that's what's leading to all the increased events that we're seeing across the nation.
which is the perfect segue to our final study of the day, one that looks at heart disease rates, which are largely plummeting across the board, except for a specific group of individuals. Top line here, over the last 30 years, heart disease rates are really done, but the study that we're going to talk about here, Dr. Patisse, shows that it applies to people of greater means. These are where we're really seeing those declines. The wealthiest individuals, heart disease risk fell from 7.7 to 5.1%. Big drop there. Second wealthiest group, 7.6 to 6.1. But then if you look at the lowest income group, those who don't necessarily have access to the higher quality healthy foods, the risk remains stagnant. Stagnant, didn't budge at 8%. So it started out higher to begin with, and it hasn't moved while the other income brackets have fallen precipitously. That is mind-blowing to me that we have not made progress in that arena yet.
Yeah, I'll be honest, Chuck, I'm not surprised at all by this data, right? And so the reason why I'm not surprised at all, because we've become a nation of the haves and the have-nots. And it's very unfortunate. So whether or not, I'm gonna start first as in the realm of just medications. We looked that there are stark disparities, financial disparities, in terms of individuals' ability to simply afford life-saving therapies, to get access to healthcare. That alone is going to increase the disparities and the gap between health and not. Now, when you add into the equation, you have food insecure areas, rich in fast food and overly processed, and that consumption that's there, that where the price point is low. So now their dollars go further for eating the foods that are killing them. Right. And so when you add this all together, it's not surprising. Then you add on top of it, the studies have shown in the past that financial stress, where you don't know where, if you're going to be able to make your rent, if you don't know if you're going to be able to pay for the lights, if they're going to go off, that stress that is associated with that is associated with increased events. So there's a lot that has to be done when we're looking at this chasm that's there in this financial, this wealth gap that exists. And so it's not a surprise. And so we have to do a better job as a society in terms of really moving folks the needle. And so there's been some subtle efforts in terms of SNAP and some, and trying to make things a little bit more amenable and stretching out where there's healthier products that are there, making it accessible for delivery. But we have a long way to go. We have a long way to go of helping those most vulnerable inside of our society to achieve a base level of health so they can be active members of the society, right? And they're not burdened. I mean, we have to think about this. If someone is having falling heart disease rates or stagnant and not improving, that means they're going to go on to develop heart failure. That means they're going to go on and they're going to likely become wards of the hospital, so to speak. They're in and out the hospital, leading to dialysis and multiple other ailments that further downturns the country and decrease the productivity, not only of them, but of their family. Now, and so this is where it's so important. I saw a patient just the other day, and I saw the ill effects from her lifestyle translate over to her kids in terms of morbid obesity, in terms of diabetes, and all the ailments that were there. And it was just very saddening to see as I kind of sat down and began the process of talking about the power of lifestyle and of nutrition, and that really we have to look at, is it affordable? Yeah, it's affordable. You know, you guys have done some wonderful work in terms of showing the affordability of eating a healthful diet, but we have to convey that. People have to understand and make it easier. What I would love to see is I'm not going to even self-promote with this. I'd love to see in grocery aisles in Walmart that we have PCRM bowls that are there, Healthy Heart Doc bowls that are there. And step one, okay, you're going to get the frozen vegetables here. Step two, you're going to get your pre-boiled rice or frozen rice or boil in the bag. Step three, here's your beans. There's going to be canned beans, BPA-free, sodium-free, that's there. Step four, here's your salsa that's here. And you begin the process where people can go and they actually know, and there's pictures. This is how your bowl is going to look. So now they're going and they're prompted on how they can really entertain this. Now, someone out there is listening. I'm not even asking for any financial contribution or anything like that. You make it happen. You just say, hey, I think I heard this one doc say that before, and we're going to make it happen. Let's make it happen. Let's get this done and make it easier for people.
I love that idea. I think that it's genius. I think that we can probably expand that into shopping apps. You know, people use their phones all the time to shop and get groceries delivered. I think that we can reach all kinds of people in all kinds of communities with that. Just to put a bow on this particular study for the nutrition nerds like me who are listening to the exam roomies, this was a survey of 27,000 individuals or so between the ages of 40 and 75 who had not yet experienced a heart attack or a stroke. And so what researchers here were looking at in particular was the risk of a cardiovascular event over a 10-year span. So 27,000 people, that is a really strong sample size. And I'm pretty sure that if you expand beyond that to just the global population, I'm sure that in most well-developed countries, you would see very similar data bore itself out. So we definitely have a long way to go. And is this something, I know that you're fresh off of the big debut of the HELP conference that you and a lot of your colleagues had. Is this something that you all discussed at the conference?
We did. We talked about really the impact in terms of financial disparities that are there and really how we can come together as a community to support. So whether or not that's in places of faith, whether or not that's inside of school systems, how we can impact the schools and a lot of strong work that's been done by you all out of New York too as well, and the growing interest in this concept of food as medicine. We have to make sure it truly is delivering food as medicine, right, based on the science. And so there was a robust discussion. I was so excited to see friends of PCRM and of myself, Milton Mills and Baxter Montgomery and Kim Williams were there, Dean and Aisha Shirzai, all attended. And so it was a very well-received, and man, I'm already looking forward to 2025.
Right on, man. Definitely keep me in the loop on that. I would love to be able to join you guys, just even not as a participant. I would just love to get in on that conference, because when you and I were talking about the lead up to 2024, I was like, man, my doc is really onto something here. This is going to be some powerful, life-changing stuff. It's not just going to be another humdrum conference. You guys really did move and shake and put that needle so far forward. It's just unbelievable. So count me in for 2025, Dr. Batiste.
Love it. Love it. Love it. Can't wait to have you there.
All right. Let's kind of put a bow on today. And let's wrap up with a question from an exam roomie by the name of Jimmy. And I don't want to frame Jimmy's story, here's the preface, as a sob story, right? I want to just kind of get some explanation as to why this could be and what some realistic expectations could be. Jimmy has done everything that we've been talking about, eliminated a lot of the salt out of his diet. Now eating a healthy whole food plant-based diet, has been doing that for a number of years, lost almost 200 pounds. But he says he recently went to the doctor and had some scans done, and it showed that there was still, quote, more than an expected amount for someone his age of calcification in the arteries. So his question to you, Doc, is it always reversible? What are some realistic expectations for somebody who was so overweight for so long moving forward with their life?
Yeah. So, you know, first, what I would tell Jimmy is, you know, congratulations on your efforts to kind of really invest in your health, in your future health thus far. I think that's powerful. Now, what we don't know is we don't know what the assessment was of your coronary arteries at the beginning of your journey to see whether or not there's been an improvement or not. We're seeing a snapshot at the current state. So it's almost like saying, well, I don't really know how much I weighed before to know how much weight I lost, although you can obviously see it in other ways. We can see it in some ways with the heart too as well, in terms of symptom manifestation if a person is symptomatic, in terms of their blood pressure levels, in case they have elevated blood pressure, in terms of their cholesterol levels, and seeing that. We do know, so yes, from the standpoint of, is cardiovascular disease, is it always reversible? I throw out those terms because it's all semantics. My main goal is to prevent you from having future events. The second goal is to kind of improve symptoms. And third goal is to kind of decrease death. And so has adopting a whole food plant-based accomplished that in the realm of cardiovascular disease? The answer is clearly yes. And there is evidence to support that there has been evidence of reversal. To the point with you, We do know too as well that some people are genetically inclined and may have an increased burden of risk based genetically in terms of their cholesterol profile that's there based on their subparticles and so forth, LDL, ApoB, et cetera, knowing what the C-reactive protein. All these things play a major role in terms of determining what if there's additional steps that have to be taken to lower a person's risk, which is ultimately always the question. How can I improve my odds of not having a future event? Right. And I'll tell you, I will never, ever, ever tell you your risk is zero because I would be lying. But what I would tell you, Jimmy, is to keep persisting. Don't be disappointed or anything about the results of showing that there's calcium burden. I would continue down the road of doing this. And I would look to add to the foundational piece of the food of what you're doing and making sure this is what Selfish Book is about, right? Is where are the components of how you're interacting from your mindset and being able to focus? That's the spirituality aspect. What's your exercise like, your activity? Because studies have shown that the more fit you are, the better your outcomes are. That means the more you're able to move and groove and do the things that you like and you should, the better off you are, the more we keep moving, the better we will become. Our relationships, how we live in the world, that's the love compulsion component of things. Forgive and gratitude becomes a key important. And then our relationships are hugely important. And don't forget about sleep, right? What's your rest like? Are you getting all these things are very additive and it all impacts your endothelium and so forth. So be encouraged by where you're at so far. I would be encouraged by where you're at.
You know, and it wouldn't surprise me if we do have a very active person in the community, the exam room, is by the name of Jimmy. And if this is that Jimmy, it would not surprise me if, you know, his energy definitely was increased. I know if it's the person I'm thinking of, they used to have chest pains, they no longer do. So that's a big plus. And I do know that their doctor is thrilled with their current cholesterol levels, saying that it's among the best that they have ever seen, as a matter of fact. So when you take that into the equation, you know, should that help Jimmy sleep a little bit better at night? I guess that's the big question here.
Absolutely. Because what you just said is what I was trying to intimate before. That's reversal. You've had reversal of symptoms. You've had decrease in blood pressure. You've had decrease in your numbers. That's powerful right there. So that should definitely help you feel better because of the fact that you're making a stride in terms of each individual step is helping you. And so I'd say down that road, it's important to be aware. I think that awareness is powerful. So I'm glad you had the scan if it was appropriate in terms of determining cholesterol meds and so forth, knowing your LPLOA, knowing your apolipoprotein B. Those things are extremely important for understanding the risk burden that you have. And if there's residual risk, your C-reactive protein, all those things are astronomically predictive of events. The coronary calcium just tells us that there was a process that happens. There's a process that happened. So we know there was a process that happened, right? That's not surprising to you. That's there. But the question is now, where are you at now? And you clearly have made changes that are demonstrable based off of cholesterol, blood pressure, if what you're saying is correct. So I would be extremely encouraged by those numbers, the weight loss, all these things. I'd be extremely encouraged by it. And I'd just stay the course.
There you go. And from my perspective, there are three words that can sum up your journey, Jimmy. Even if you're feeling slightly deflated by that scan, never give up. Those are your three words. Keep going. That's because right. As Dr. Patisse just said, and as I'm sure you feel a lot better. You know you're so much healthier. And so don't let this one little test, you know, deflate this amazing balloon that you've been blowing up here, right? You want to keep this thing nice and inflated and living a healthy and happy life. So keep on going, Jimmy. And Dr. Patisse, let's wrap up. Talk about your book coming out April 30th, Selfish, A Cardiologist's Guide to Healing a Broken Heart. Man, I'm so pumped for this. You were on the show a little bit earlier this year talking about it. And I just can't wait to get my hands on a copy of this.
Oh, man, I can't wait to get you one, too, as well. First, this hit me, though, as you're talking about Jimmy. One last thing for Jimmy, right? If you just had, let's say you had to have surgery on your knee and you had a scar. The knee is great now. You've gone through rehab. You're doing everything. But you see someone comes back and they identify a scar that's there. That doesn't mean there's a problem. It means that there was an event that happened that now the repair and recovery has taken place. So the fact that you may have some calcium burden, it may be reflective of the prior events that occurred, but now your process of what you're doing has really healed you. And so why I wanted to bring that back full circle is because this can bring about a fair amount of stress. We talk about the power and the impact of stress. It's so pervasive, whether it's financial, whether or not it's worrying about future events that we have zero control over, ultimately. All we can do is try and put things in place to mitigate it, right? And so this book is really about decreasing the stress burden, about how it relates to the heart, and about how the power of each of the pillars has been shown and demonstrated to, number one, decrease stress, and number two, really heal a broken heart, to heal that endothelium, to improve the heart failure, to potentially reverse and stabilize cardiovascular disease. And so the pillars of selfish are spiritual, which means our breath, the mindfulness, the meditation, the prayer, all these things that have a power in terms of decreasing our stress burden and lowering our blood pressure and cardiovascular events, are the power of exercise. I don't mean CrossFit, Peloton. I mean just simply walking. I mean forest bathing. I mean getting out in the sunlight, the power that exists with it. The L stands for love, which means forgiveness, forgiving ourselves, right? Forgiving others, not holding on to things, the gratitude, the volunteering. These are all the actionable aspects of love, that when we embrace that, studies have shown increased longevity, decreased blood pressure that's there. The F is a central component, and that's food, real food, whole food, plant-rich foods. And you all listening know the power of that. The I stands for the intimacy, the power of relationships. Chuck, you've built a community here. You built a community beyond, without you even knowing about, people come to you, listen to you and to the guests you bring on, because it creates community that empowers and gets them the further on. And so we know this. There's many instances I give in the book about the power of community and what we can learn from trees. Here's the thing about trees, right? And to give you a little snippet of this, is in case you don't know, is that trees actually communicate in what they call the worldwide wood, right? And they communicate inside this area, sharing nutrients. Tall trees with small trees that aren't able to get the sunlight that they share, they warn about devastation that's ensuing. And there's power in community that we need to embrace. The power of sleep is the second S, of sleep or rest or vacation or time away, of moments for yourself. And then the power that has in terms of cardiovascular events, hypertension and stress, be able to deal with tomorrow's stressors. And then the H stands for humor, the joy of life, and really looking at the power. And I'll end with this little caveat I share inside the book. I'm over at cardiac rehab for my medical group, and cardiac rehab is where many of you are familiar with Dean Ornish and the work he's done. That's essentially cardiac rehabilitation. And that's where we put you through exercise and nutrition and mindfulness and so forth. And so extremely beneficial. But in this particular state, what they did is they had individuals laugh. They said, I want you to laugh. I don't care what it is, 30 minutes every day. Watch your silliest comedy show. Watch the comedian who's telling a off-cuff joke and laugh. When they looked and compared the groups, those who laugh versus those who didn't, it's not a surprise. Those who laugh had less burden of chest pain. They had less admissions to the hospital. They had improved outcomes. And so this is one example of many about the power of laughter, what it does to our endothelium, what it does to our outlook and our mindset. And so I would definitely encourage you to get the book, to realize that food is the central core, but it's supported by all these pillars that help you become the best version of yourself. You gotta get selfish. Get selfish if you want this thing called health.
And you can get selfish on Dr. Batiste's website, drbatiste.com. Also, be sure to follow him on Instagram at healthyheartdoc. The book comes out April 30th. Pre-orders available right now. Be among the first to get it. So drbatiste.com, or click that link that we've dropped down below in the show description and in the episode notes. Dr. Columbus Batiste, you have been a treat as always. Thank you so very much, my friend.
It's good to see you. Thanks so much.
So to answer the question about industry funding in that egg study, that answer is a big old yes with a capital Y. The entire study was funded by Eggland's Best, which is a brand of fortified eggs. And on top of that, one of the lead authors of the study has also received funding from Eggland's Best. So that's something to keep in mind, not just for this study, but literally any study you ever find out there. Who funded it? Where are those dollars coming from?
It's the same reason why you've heard Dr. Neil Barnard say on the show before, we won't even take money from a broccoli company because our data needs to be above reproach. Independence when it comes to nutrition studies and any scientific research is always so critically important. So please keep that in mind the next time you start to see data from studies plastered all over everywhere. Who funded them? Do a little bit of research, become a detective yourself, and you might be surprised, and it might cause you to rethink a thing or two. So back specifically to this egg study, the researchers here concluded that eating a dozen fortified eggs every week does not significantly impact cholesterol levels among people who are at risk for cardiovascular disease. And that is compared to eating two or fewer eggs every week. But even in this case, despite the fact that some funding came from Eggland's Best, or by some, I mean all, researchers also admit that there are limitations to the study. The data, for instance, was self-reported by participants. And as Dr. Batiste mentioned on the show, that can also be problematic. And because the participants knew they were participating in a study, did they make changes to their diet that would skew the findings? Or maybe they became a little more health conscious in other areas of their life? Maybe they skipped the butter on their toast in the morning, or opted not to have sausage or bacon with that breakfast as well. Maybe they opted for fruit or oatmeal instead. The fact is, we don't know, and that is why the study fairly suggests that additional research is needed. So thank you to Dr. Batiste for helping us dive into that one. Be sure to check him out on drbatiste.com and pick up a copy of his book, Selfish. Links to both right now are in the episode notes. And as a reminder, if you are in the Seattle area, Carly Bodrug and I will be at the Planted Expo on April 21st. The whole event is a two-day extravaganza, April 20th and 21st, at the Seattle Convention Center. And we're not the only ones there. I'm telling you, we're spreading goodness out over 2 days. Dr. Michael Greger, Robert Cheek, Ella Majors, Doug McNish, Desiree Nelson, Nimai Delgado, our friends Dr. Jim Loomis and Karen Dugan, known worldwide as the Doc and Chef, they're going to be there as well, and so many others. We're talking about thousands of Plant Forward fans and exam roomies, and you can be among them. Going to be a great time, and there's a special offer just for the roomies. 15% off tickets, single day and weekend passes, 15% off can be yours using the special code EXAMROOM at checkout. That is one word, EXAMROOM, for 15% off tickets. All you need to do is head over to plantedlife.com to secure yours or click the link in the episode notes. And then on Monday, April 22nd, Dr. Neil Barnard comes to Seattle with the Power Foods Lecture Series. That's going to be at the Public Library's Central Branch with a 7 o'clock start time. Quick disclaimer, any views that are discussed at the event are not the reflection of the Seattle Public Library. But that doesn't mean you're not going to learn a thing or two and raise your health IQ with a little nutrition knowledge. So that's going to be a great time. You can head over to pcrm.org/events for more details there. And then on May 16th and 17th, I'm going to be in Rochester, Minnesota, home of the Mayo Clinic, for the Lifestyle Medicine Pathway to Health and Happiness Symposium. Fun event presented by the Lotus Health Foundation. And tickets and a full list of speakers are available right now as well at lotushealthfoundation.org, where again, click that link in the episode notes. And one more click for you, if you haven't already followed or subscribed to the Exam Room podcast by the Physicians Committee, what are you waiting for? Head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is that you get your shows. Just look for the Exam Room by the Physicians Committee. Hit that follow button or click subscribe. And when you do, please also leave a 5-star rating. And from time to time, we also love to read reviews of the show here on the podcast. And so if you would like to tell us a little bit about why it is you like the show, how you've used it to raise your health IQ, or what a plant-based diet has done for your health, go ahead, drop that in the review. We might be able to read that here on the show as well. And believe you me, every new subscription and 5-star rating and review really does help to make the difference in someone else's life. It helps to get this show in front of as many eyes and ears as humanly possible. And that is what we are here to do. We are here to make the world a healthier place. And for today, that is going to wrap things up. I want to say thank you one more time to Dr. Columbus Batiste for being here as we continue to raise our heart health IQs. And for everyone at the Physicians Committee, I am the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll. Thank you so very much for listening. And remember, as always, keep it plant-based.